Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And as always, along with your call, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, sex and seniors. We're going to talk about whether or not you should have a talk with grandpa about using the proper precaution when they may be having some sexual activity, a reversal in roles.
And
then we're going to talk about the nocebo effect. We've always talked about the placebo effect. We're going to talk about the nocebo effect, a term that was just recently coined in the journal Lancet, a prestigious medical journal.
And a good listener recipe.
Of course. We only have good listener recipes. We have great listeners, so we have great listener recipes. Chuck's Garden Soup. Soup, and it's delicious.
This one from Mineral Point, Wisconsin, listener Chuck Pound, coming up in about 25 minutes from now. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. To the phones we go, Zorba. A listener with us now in Brooklyn, New York. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
So I am training for my second marathon. I started about 3 months ago. And I have a 7-month-old baby who I'm breastfeeding. In the past 3 months, I've actually been taken to the hospital twice after two long runs. One was 12 miles, and one was 16 miles.
Ooh, taken to the hospital for what?
For potassium, basically electrolyte imbalance. The first time I had to be treated, I had to take a big potassium pill. And then the second time, which was more serious and more recent, actually, it was hyponatremia, and it had a very low sodium sodium level. So basically my question is, you know, I really want to train for this marathon. I'm doing it for a charity this year, but I don't want to go to the hospital again, and I'm wondering if postpartum hormones and breastfeeding could, you know, have anything to do with this, because I've never had anything like this happen before, and I've been a runner for years.
Sure. You've been running for a long time, you said.
I have, yeah. This is would be my second marathon.
I've got a couple questions. What they ask you when you were at the hospital and you had the hyponatremia, which means low sodium, what advice did they give you?
You know, I didn't get great advice, which was part of my frustration. They said, don't run the marathon.
Don't do this. You know,
don't
hey, I broke up with my girlfriend. I broke up with my boyfriend. Okay, don't do that again. Don't do that. Well, you know, that's sort of, you know, old-fashioned motherly advice that is clearly not there. You know why you had hyponatremia, right? Or you don't know?
I do. No, I am aware. And I think, you know, the weird
So why'd you have it if you're aware?
Because I had too much water and not enough sodium.
Right. Well, you had too much water. The sodium is irrelevant. You overhydrated. That's why you had the hyponatremia, period. It's not that you didn't have enough sodium. It's that you had too much water. It's kind of a simple formula for that, because the body regulates sodium well. And if you look at the number of deaths among marathoners, people who are in marathoners, it's because of hyponatremia and low sodium and overhydration.
It's not
from dehydration. It's from too much hydration. And I've got some ways to treat that. Now, the other time you had hypokalemia, right? Too low potassium. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Same thing.
Oh, potassium, yes.
Same thing. It turns out to be it's a hydration issue. So when you're breastfeeding, you have to drink more water because you've got to make sure you keep up your milk supply. And you don't always pay attention to your thirst when you're breastfeeding. You know, a lot of breastfeeding women will say, hey, I need to drink more water, and they just drink it. So you're in, I don't want to call it compulsive behavior, but you're in a behavior that's overriding the natural tendency of how much to drink based on your thirst. And that's because you want to make sure that your baby is okay and has enough milk.
Right.
But I've got some ideas, and I'll tell you what I would recommend doing. What you want to do is base the drinking, number one, on thirst. So if you're thirsty, you can drink, but you're drinking whatever it is too much. Monitor how much you're drinking. Drink out of a smaller container, we'll say, instead of a large, you know, Nalgene or whatever you're using to drink when you're running. You want to drink a smaller amount. Look at your urine. If your urine is concentrating, you're not drinking enough water. If your urine is, you know, very, very light tea colored, you're drinking too much water. And visually, that's probably how I would handle it. If you've gone there twice, you really can't depend on either your behavior or your sense of thirst while you're actually running.
Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. You're welcome. How old's your baby now?
She's 7.5 months. She's doing great. Yep, she's teething, so no sleep for us.
No sleep. Yeah. Brothers, as the father of four kids, I do remember those days, and it's fun to have a baby, and one of those days they will sleep through the night. So good luck.
Thank you.
And have a good run.
I hope it's true. Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
800-462-7413. It's toll-free. 1-800-462-7413. To a St. Louis, Missouri caller we go, Zorba. Hi.
Hello, y'all. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. What's up?
Well, my wife is pregnant, and we're getting all the pregnancy advice and everything like that, more than we can shake a stick at. But part of we're developing and finding out we have a lot more differences in how we look at health than we thought we had. She's really interested in homeopathic remedies and naturopath remedies and chiropractic stuff, and I'm not really against any of that, but I don't really know a whole lot about it. I know that we're less concerned about what are we going to do about the pregnancy. Things are going really smoothly, but especially even out in the future, I realize she's really going to get excited about this stuff for a long time to come, as far as I can tell. I was really wondering what kind of reliable sources and authorities should I be trusting in all of these homeopathic remedies. I just kind of want to know, how do I weed out what's good and what's not?
You bring up issues that a lot of people really grapple with. How do you evaluate things that are not necessarily evaluated scientifically? I recently went to a lecture, and it was a very interesting lecture, and the guy made a comment that I thought really stands true to how people think about things, and he said, anecdotes trump numbers all the time when people make decisions. And I thought about that, and I thought, this happens in my office every day. I'll say, well, you know, you got to quit smoking. And a lot of times smokers will say, you know, my grandfather lived until 90 years old. He drank a quart of whiskey a day and smoked cigarettes. Right. And I thought, you're right. Here it is. I'm giving him the numbers, and he's telling me the anecdote, and that's trumping the number. And with a lot of herbal remedies, that's what goes. And the reason is we actually don't have any numbers. We don't really have scientific herbal remedies that make any sense. But I've got some suggestions that I think are important. First of all, every single time you would take a supplement, only take a supplement that has been tested to be proven and true. And I'll explain why. But there are two companies that I like to do this. Absolutely two. ConsumerReports.org. They make the magazine. If you don't want to pay $25 a year on the web, which you can do, you can go to a library. Most libraries have it online. You go into the library. They've got it online, or they've got the magazines. Look up a supplement. If they've tested it, only take the ones they say are correct to take. Period. Don't bother with the other ones, because I don't know if they work or they don't work. The other organization I like is called Consumer Labs, C-O-N-S-U-M-E-R, consumerlabs.org. They also do independent testing, and they do as much or more than Consumer Reports. Again, $25 a year, but you save it. And if you're going to take a supplement, take that. Now, do they work? Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. The Mayo Clinic has a wonderful integrative medicine program, and they have a book out. I can't remember the exact name, but if you Google Mayo and integrative medicine at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any other site or bookstore, it'll come up. And they've looked at a lot of these remedies to see if they work. I think that's a good balanced book to kind of think about.
And you're okay, Zorba, with things like acupuncture and chiropractic?
Absolutely. Acupuncture, chiropractic, homeopathy. Homeopathy generally is safe, but once again, you want to make sure the stuff you're consuming is safe. For your wife, if she's got a naturopathic physician and gets delivered by a midwife, 95% of all deliveries really end up just fine. But you have to have, for a baby, I think, standard medical practice backup. And the reason is, since Western medicine has entered obstetrics 120 years ago, we've dropped the mortality rate by 99%. Huge number, 99%. Now, that doesn't mean every woman should have an IV by any means or have medicine, but you want to have that backup just in case. Just like you buckle up a seatbelt when you're in a car, you pay attention to your speed, and when it's icy outside, you're careful. It's the same thing with having a baby. So I don't think you should just go to the naturopathic remedy, nor do I think you have to go the Western way.
Great. those are really helpful. That's a lot of really good resources I can double-check, and we can look at it together so we can actually see what's been tested, what's not.
You know what? You just brought up a really important point. We can look at it together, and that's exactly the way that it's going to be with your baby. It's going to be that way with immunizations, breastfeeding, of course, which we know breast is best, certainly for the first year of life, and how you're going to really raise your child. You want to raise it as a unit, and that's the best way to raise your kids.
Great. That's really helpful, y'all. I really do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, some health problems with the elderly having sex?
Yes. It's interesting. I was giving a lecture probably about a year ago in Tampa, and this guy was showing me around, and he was showing me around to, I think it was a senior place called the Cottages or something like that. He said it was a huge area, 55 and over. People go around with golf carts. They have restaurants there, a wonderful place. And he said, this is a great place. I just want to go. We were going by it. He said, you know what it's known for? And I said, no, what? He said, it's known for having the highest rate of sexually transmitted diseases in the state of Florida. And as I went by and I saw a gray-haired guy and a gray-haired woman in a car just kind of smiling and going around, I thought, they're right. When my mother died many years ago, my father had three girlfriends, one for golf, one that he went out to, one that he went out to fundraisers, and one that he brought to the family. And I thought, because he was the guy in town, you know, the rooster in the coop. And so, but this turns out to be a big issue. In Florida, in 2009, 20% of all the new HIV cases and 25% of all the AIDS cases in Florida were in men and women over 50 years of age.
Over half the people in Florida are over.
That's right. So maybe that's not any different from exactly the people are in Florida. But I'll tell you one thing that is really important. It's important to actually talk about sex if you have a parent or a loved one who is dating, because a lot of senior citizens don't really think about it.
Yeah.
And they don't really think that they're at risk. They think of sexually transmitted diseases as occurring in people who are younger. And the fact is, they also occur in people that are older.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's probably just as uncomfortable for an adult 50, or we'll say 40, talking to a grandfather 75 as it is with an adult 40 talking to a kid who's 14 or 15. Now it's true. A lot of senior citizens are not having sexual intercourse. When they're older, they're going around for companionship. And sometimes they're insulted and they're saying, well, why would I have sex with that person? But I don't see anything insulting about saying you're going to have sex with somebody else.
No.
And it's a cultural issue. In Germany, sex is considered to be just a part of aging, part of young and being older, and they're very, very open about that discussion. Whereas England, you know, don't talk to me about sex, I'm English. Yeah. And we're much more English and puritanical and Victorian in our culture. So,
and of course, elderly, I suppose, just like teenagers, think they already know everything.
Yes, so yes. But I mean, we're talking about people over 50. Do you think people over 50 are elderly, Tom?
No, I don't.
Not at all. Elderly is somebody who's 25 years older than you.
Right, but you were talking about people in homes and that sort of thing.
Well, I'm talking about people in retirement centers, not necessarily in nursing homes or assisted living. The reality is sex in any age group is great. It's wonderful. It's part of life. Viagra, Levitra, and Cialis allow you to have sex at an older and older time. They're wonderful medications that allow people to enjoy life through the life space. But like every other disease, use protection.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a Bozeman, Montana caller is with us now. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Well, I was on a round of clindamycin for a wound infection, and because I developed a cellulitis, and then 2 weeks after I stopped the clindamycin, I was diagnosed with C. diff, and then I started Flagyl for 10 days, and then when I started the Flagyl, I started a probiotic. And I'm about 3 weeks out now, and I was wondering if I should still continue the probiotic and for how long I should be taking it still, and if there's something else I should be taking
Well,
so before you answer, what is it we're talking about?
Right, exactly. That's exactly it. That's what I was. That's what I was thinking. So first of all, she had an infection, a cellulitis, right?
Yes.
Right. So she had an infection.
Yeah.
She was given an antibiotic called clindamycin, right?
Yes.
Yes. See. So okay. Clindamycin is a commonly used antibiotic, but it can have a side effect of decreasing the good bacteria in the body. And so something called C. difficile, which is one of the bad bacteria, came up and started to bother her, and she had diarrhea, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And then you have to take another antibiotic. This is called Flagyl to get rid of it, correct?
Correct.
Now, here's the issue. She wants to repopulate her intestine with good bacteria, mm-hmm. and so she's using a probiotic. And the question is, how long do you use it?
Okay.
So there's no tried and true number, but I would stand it longer versus shorter, because what you're doing is just repopulating lactobacillus and other good bacteria. And whether or not the probiotic works better, we'll say, than yogurt with active culture, is kind of up for debate. But I think probiotics are great, as long as they're manufactured the right way. How'd you choose which probiotic to use?
Well, I did a little bit of research. I listened to a couple of these vitamin shows on mm-hmm. the radio,
yeah.
and then I know my dad, who has been into vitamins and supplements mm-hmm. for 25 years,
uh-huh.
he suggested this certain one, okay. so this is what I'm taking.
What I think I would do, and I mentioned this before, I'd go to consumerreports.org, and we'll put this up on our website, or consumerlabs.org, O-R-G. Consumer Reports, I know you can get at a library, Consumer Lab. They both cost about $25 to belong to their websites. And I would look up probiotics, and I would use the ones they tested. That's what I would do. And the reason
okay.
is those are ones that are valid. I like scientific testing when it comes to supplements because the feds don't regulate them, period. So even though your dad is into vitamins and he's had it, I would respectfully go and use the ones that have been tested. And those are the two sites that I like because I think they give really, really good information. Now, are you taking yogurt every day?
I do. I have a cup of yogurt.
Yogurt is great, and it's a good yogurt that says active culture. Have you read the label on the yogurt?
Yes.
So I would stay on yogurt, and I would probably stay in the probiotics longer. I'd probably do it another month or two because C. diff tends to come back for a while. And if your stools aren't back to normal, I would just assume there may be still a little bit of C. diff in your system somewhere, and I would just use the probiotics and yogurt. And anytime you ever take an antibiotic again, you want to make sure you really need it. Antibiotics are overused by doctors. We all overuse them because patients say, I really want an antibiotic. In your case, it's got to be a good reason. And I would stay away from clindamycin unless I absolutely needed it. Clinda's one of the antibiotics that is more prone to it. Any antibiotic can do it, but in your case, I would say Clinda, not unless it's a life-threatening disease.
Right. I mean, it was a cellulitis that I had, so it was like,
oh, sure.
I don't know if I had a choice or not.
Oh, sure.
But,
well, you do. There are other antibiotics that you would use. I think Clinda was a good first choice, but from now on, I would stay away from it. Good luck. Eat your yogurt.
I will. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for the call. Before we take a short break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox for this quick question from a concerned grandma named Mary. And by the way, you are really an expert on this. Mary writes, Dr. Zorba, I have a 13-year-old grandson who's allergic to dogs. I am, for the first time, considering getting a dog, a standard poodle. I've been told that these dogs do not affect allergy sufferers. Is this true?
100%. No, it's not 100%.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect most allergy sufferers. There's some allergy sufferers that can still be allergic to anything. But I would say for 90% of the allergy sufferers, the poodles are great. And let me tell you something. I mean, I've got to give a disclaimer.
Yeah.
I'm a standard poodle owner,
yep.
and they are the brightest dogs in the world. I know the collie people will say their dogs are smart, but hey, my dog reads the New York Times. He's smarter than your collie.
Yeah. My Basset is smarter than most Bassets, but that isn't saying a lot.
No, it's not saying much. And I have to tell you, I looked at a New Yorker cartoon. It showed a dog driving the car, and it said, my Border Collie is smarter than your honor student.
Well, okay, Mr. Poodle is great and Mr. Know-It-All. Do you know the name of Marilyn Monroe's poodle?
Oh, of course not. Not in the least. What was it?
Mafia. Other famous poodle owners that Mary May joined the ranks of: Churchill, Picasso, Walt Disney, and Ed Sullivan, and of course,
Dr. Zorba Pastor. Zorba Pastor. There we go. I'm in the good club.
We always are here to paw around your lifestyle questions. Just send them to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, lots more of your calls, some more interesting research to talk over, our medical myth buster. The list goes on of good reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but you'll find a line open for you at 800-462-7413. But, of course, before our next call, it is recipe time. This one from Mineral Point, Wisconsin, listener Chuck Pound. We will be putting together Chuck's Garden Soup. Hi, Chuck.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Fine, thanks. And how did you come up with Chuck's Garden Soup?
Well, every morning before I go to work in the summer, I go out in the garden and I see what's for lunch. Mm-hmm. And this is what was for lunch that day.
So you've been gardening for how long?
Oh, only 3-4 years, something like that, very seriously. We've always had a small garden, but we've put in a larger one in the since the economy has gone down a little bit.
A victory garden.
Out of the garden. Yes, more or less.
I understand, Chuck, that you have an alternate name for that soup based on how you created it. What's that?
Oh, what the garden provided for lunch today, soup?
Well, that works.
I love it. I love it. It's a bit long. It would be hard to actually put on a recipe thing, but I love it. It's what the garden. I love veggies. And,
well, that's the name of it in my recipe book.
I love it. I love it. Now, do your parents garden?
My parents?
No,
no, I don't think they ever have, in fact.
Yeah, no, you would know that. My parents garden. In fact, my father had a garden, and then my grandfather had a garden. And what I remember as a kid is my father and my grandfather continuously arguing over how to plant the garden, how to prune the trees, how to get things. And guess who was a better gardener, my father or my grandfather?
Your father.
No,
oh, your
not
grandfather.
At all. My grandfather was a great gardener. My father was awful.
But your dad lived in Chicago. How did he garden?
Well, they had a garden. You could have a victory garden. Garden in Chicago. We had a postage stamp house with a postage stamp yard, and it was filled with a garden, tomatoes and cucumbers and other things. You know, I mean, you know, if you're into gardening, you like it.
Well, you have some soil and some sunlight.
That's it. That's it. Soil and sunlight, and you've got a garden. And if you don't have the soil and sunlight, you can use the soil and sunlight in your
I'm sorry,
garden.
But these days there's neither in Chicago.
There's neither.
The buildings are that high.
That's it.
There's
that's
no
it.
Soil,
that's
no
it.
Sunlight.
That's it. There it is. There's
then
no
you
garden.
Go to the rooftop and put on pots up there.
There we are. You see, you can do it in Chicago.
Let's put this recipe
together. Okay, Chuck's Garden Soup, or that alternate, whatever is in the garden soup recipe. Okay, so start out with 2 beets chopped small. These are regular traditional beets?
Yes.
When you make beets, do you end up taking off the outside of the beet? Do you end up, or do you just sort of chop them up?
I skin them with a potato peeler.
With a potato peeler. So you skin the beets. I do that, too. I wonder if you really have to skin the beets. I was thinking about that with carrots the other day, and I thought, can I wash the outside? Do I really have to take the skin off the outside of the carrot? And because there are a lot of vitamins and minerals that are on the outside of a potato, and I don't know if there are more vitamins and minerals on the outside of the carrot or on the outside of the beet. I wonder, I bet someone will actually give us that information.
Well, I'd be surprised.
Don't you think one of
because the carrot doesn't have have a skin like a potato.
That's
does.
True, but a beet, the outside of the beet is a little different than the inside of the beet.
Maybe so a young beet you might be able to get away with it. The old ones, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, they're kind of tough and rubbery. Somebody will probably chime in on our website with that. Okay, one potato chopped small. You don't peel the potato, correct?
Right.
Okay, one potato. See, so he does that. An onion chopped small. Red, white, yellow.
They happen to have been yellow because that's what I had picked already.
That's what you had. A tomato chopped nice and small. What kind of tomatoes do you have in your garden?
Oh, several. I'm not sure the varieties, tell you the truth.
Yeah, I like different kinds. I like the pear tomatoes when I'm making sauce, and I like the nice round tomatoes. I sometimes beefsteak when I'm going to have a burger. Do you like tomatoes, Tom?
Oh,
are you
a
tomato person?
Sure.
Yeah. One jalapeno chopped. A 1 cup of potatoes now cut into bite size. So you've got a small, one potato small, and then a cup of bite-sized tomatoes. You mean cubes? Is that what you do?
Yes. The ingredients before this was going to go into the soup stock base, and then now you're going into some chunks of food.
Stuff that's
going to
float
in character.
Perfect. 2 cups of green beans cut bite size. Green, yellow, what kind of green beans?
Yeah. Oh, mine were Vortex green beans.
Which are good. I like green beans a lot. 2 banana peppers cut bite size. You've got a nice garden here. 20 basil leaves.
20
basil leaves.
Well, I didn't know how to measure it. Approximately, you know, half a cup, something like that.
I've got a deal for you, Chuck. Our producer, Adam Friedrich, has a way overgrown basil bush he'd be happy to share with you.
A lot of people would like to have that.
That's exactly right. In fact, he's willing to share it, to send it anywhere across the country. FedEx,
watch your
on his dime.
Watch your door stoop.
That's right. We're going to call it Adam's Basil Leaves, and he's going to have a business on the side there of basil. You know, he's got to take it. You know, we're going to take a picture of his basil bush, and we're going to put it up on our website, zorbapastor.org. You're going to see a picture of it, and it's also going to be on our Facebook page, and I'm going to tweet all about the benefits of basil. There we go. Basil is going to be there. Okay, a cup of cucumber seeded, cut into small pieces, and then cheese to top. Now, being from Wisconsin, what kind of cheese? This is the most important part of the recipe. What kind of cheese are you going to top it with?
I don't know if this is a Wisconsin cheese. We just happen to have those little teeny wrapped up laughing cow baby bells.
Baby bells. We don't know if they're from Wisconsin, but we do know that it's – I like baby bell cheese. I have them all wrapped up because I use them for snacks. Mm-hmm. But any cheese is great on the top.
Yep, we had them because they were good, easy snack food.
Yeah. So anything. Okay, so let's make the recipe. Cook the beets, potato, onion, tomato, and jalapeno in about 2 cups of water for about 60 minutes for about 60 minutes. You can do it in the microwave, and you could certainly do it on the stove. Mash everything together, but not too much. What does that mean?
Well, you don't want I don't want a total smooth puree out of it. Mm-hmm. I want a little bit of texture in there. Uh-huh.
I think that's a good point. If you creamed it, it would be more puree, which you could put in your food processor, your blender. But I think mashing it gives it a nice texture and taste, which would be my choice. Then add the potatoes. That's the 1 cup of potatoes, bite size. Add the green beans, banana peppers. Cook about 5 minutes until done. Then add 3 tomatoes and basil, and let it sit for a few minutes for the tomatoes to warm and the basil to give their nice aroma. Top with the cucumber. I love this. Top it with the cucumber and then put your favorite cheese on top of it. I would choose butter queso, which has become my new favorite melting cheese because it's got a nice fullness, a nice umami to it at the top of it. I love it. I know that our listeners are going to want to write in for this recipe, but they can't write it in.
You can write it down, but don't bother sending it. It's not convenient.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this recipe. Chuck's Garden Soup. Thank you, Chuck.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, if listeners want this recipe, what can they really do?
Well, they can go to zorbapastor.org. And while you're there, you can also, besides finding this recipe, sign up for our weekly recipe podcast. Search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's zorbapastor.org. Oh, and don't forget, you can find us on Facebook. And if you go to Facebook or our website, you will see me tweet.
And by the way, for sending us this winning recipe, Chuck gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low-Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
zorbapastor.org.
(800) 462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener in Wichita, Kansas with us. Hi.
Well, hi, Dr. Zorba and Tom. What fun to talk to you.
What fun to have you here. How can we help?
I will be retiring soon and relocating to a remote area where I will be off the electric grid. I expect to be heating with a wood stove. And my question is whether or not an accumulation of ash would be bad for my body. I expect to be making little ash cakes, which is just little patties of dough that you throw into the white-hot ashes after the fire's died down.
Now, you might not want to tell us, because this sounds like a really remote, maybe secret place, but can you give us a hint as to where in the heck you're going to be?
It is a very well-kept secret. It's near the Capitol Reef National Park area in south-central Utah. It's just heaven on earth.
I've been to Utah numerous times. I love it. It's a beautiful state. Moab and the area around Moab, I did some wonderful hiking and camping. Arches, it's just a gorgeous place.
Well, give us the address so we can all visit.
Yeah, that's right.
If we had addresses, I would share it with you.
I love it. Tell me about these ash cakes. I don't really understand what they are.
You just mix flour and water and a little bit of salt, make a dough out of it, pat it into little patty cakes, and after the fire has died down to white hot ashes, you just flip them into the ashes and let them cook for about 3 or 4 minutes, flip them over with a stick, cook a little bit more, and then you just knock the dust off, knock the ashes off. And but I just wonder if I'll be doing this long-term. Over a long period of time, it sort of seems to me like the carbon in the ashes might actually purify your system, but I wonder if there's any drawback to consuming that much ash over a period of long time.
Well, there are a couple of issues that you do have to consider. The first and most important issue is the particulate matter that you're breathing in when you're around a fire. In other words, fires are dirty. They're dirty. You know, using organic material, it's going into the air. Of course, it depends on if you're outside. If you're outside, it's not nearly the same as if you have a fire inside. So that's one consideration. It's not like smoking, but it's kind of like smoking. You know, when you inhale smoke, you run a risk of lung disease. And it doesn't matter how organic it is, and nothing could be more organic than actually starting a fire with wood. So the particulate matter in the air on a regular basis is a thing of concern. And I mention that because I care for a number of Tibetans who escaped Tibet in 1959 and basically had maybe the first 10 or 20 years of their life in a fire that used dung for the most part. And some of them have chronic lung disease. They weren't smoking. They were monks. But they have chronic lung disease to some extent from the dung, and that's really from the ash and the particulate matter. So when you're cooking, if you're outside or even inside, making sure that it's well ventilated, that's probably the most important thing. Consuming the ash, I bet there's no scientific study out there that looks at people who consume ash, but I can't imagine that it's something that would actually be bad for you. I don't think the carbon would actually cure anything in your system, but we do know that we give people, quote, activated charcoal. And we give it to them. We used to give it in large amounts to help with poisoning. And in fact, we still give in large amounts for some people with poisoning, and it's not considered bad. And charcoal is, to the most part, very, very similar to ash. So I don't think you'll get into any trouble GI-wise in your gut. I think I'd pay more attention to the smoke.
I hadn't thought about that. I'll be using a wood-burning stove, of course, but there'll be some opening and closing of the door to do these ashes. So I'll just see how much smoke I release into the house.
You got it.
I give you about 6 months there before you're back in Wichita.
Oh, no. You haven't seen heaven yet.
You're going to miss your friends, and you're going to miss that great steak dinner at the best restaurant in town.
And where is that?
You're there, and I'm not. I don't
it's
know.
Buffett's.
I don't know.
It's Buffett's restaurant, but that's Omaha that I'm thinking of. So.
That's Omaha. I'll settle for ash cakes.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And before we step aside for a short break, Zorba, we have a little business to take care of with the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police.
They're always watching. They're there to protect our language.
Indeed. This one comes to us from Deputy Jim of the Belmont, Wisconsin branch of the ZGP. Jim says you have a homonym issue. Jim writes, on a recent show, Zorba, you said that Google and Google are homonyms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whoops.
Right, right.
But you were close. A homonym is one of a group of words that share the same spelling and the same pronunciation, mm-hmm. but have different meanings. For example, stalk, part of a plant, and stalk, follow and harass.
Right.
Google,
right.
the internet search engine, mm-hmm. and Google, one followed by 100 zeros, are homophones, words
homophones?
That have the same pronunciation but different spellings.
I had no idea.
Then there are homographs.
Homographs?
Words with different pronunciation, meanings, and origins, but the same spelling.
Is
For
this
example,
going to be on the test?
Like, this is like bow, the way a ribbon is tied, uh-huh. and bow, to bend at the waist. And as I said, you
wow.
were close, near, and not close, which I am now doing to this email. I have a homophone for you. Write in right now to share your thoughts or lifestyle questions with the show. Just send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some more research coming up. We have more of your calls. We have our medical myth buster, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, it is now time, Zorba, for our next topic. Really interesting. We talk about placebos all the time here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I've never heard of a nocebo.
That's right, a nocebo effect. So first of all, the placebo effect is to please. That's mm-hmm. what it comes from the Latin phrase, Latin word, which means to please. So in other words, you tell people, I think this is going to work. And then a certain number of people, it works. So if you look at double-blind placebo-controlled trials,
yeah.
we'll say on back pain, mm-hmm. Let's give an example where 40 to 50% of the people on the active medication may say, yeah, this drug really works. Well, 20 to 30% of the people on the placebo also say it works.
Because they think it's going to work.
Because they yeah. think it's going to work. And so what you're doing is you're activating
yeah.
part of going into the doctor and getting on top of the pain.
So what's
the nocebo effect is where the doctor explains there may be side effects, and then you get side effects from it because of the explanation.
Oh, just same effect, but in the opposite.
In the negative realm. Yeah. And, of course, we're at a point in our society where we have to declare side effects. You want to know the side effects of them. But this particular article looked at and study from the journal Lancet looked at side effects from cancer treatment, nausea, fatigue, dizziness, pain, gastrointestinal symptoms, all of these things that occur. And the people who were told, look, these are important side effects, you may get them, were much more likely to get them than people who essentially were handed a sheet of paper with the side effects and they weren't really prompted about the side effect at much because the conversation was triggering the side effects.
Yeah. Now, I know that this exists because when I go to see my family doc,
yes,
my family doc often kind of soft pedals or doesn't mention the possible side effects. My guess is because he wants to make sure my mind isn't clouded.
Is not set for those side effects. That's exactly it. In fact, I'll give you a good example. In a randomized study of aspirin in patients with unstable angina, so in other words, they've got chest pain, the more gastrointestinal symptoms were more highly likely in the placebo group than actually in the aspirin group because everyone said, aspirin, it'll upset my stomach. And basically, the placebo was upsetting their stomach. In fact, it was just the thought of it that was upsetting
their stomach. But a lot of times, it's kind of important that you do know what the side effects might be.
Oh, you need full disclosure. There's no doubt about it. We're not going back to the old days where the doctor said, I know what's good for you. I'm not going to tell you the side effects of medicine. Those days are gone. The issue is you want to make sure that you give the information in an appropriate way. And then you also want to, if you are getting that medication, what are the chances that I'm going to get this? And think about that and make a decision with the physician. Don't simply read about the side effects or read about them on the web. Talk to somebody who knows what the risks and benefits are and then figure out if they apply to you.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is in Weatherford, Texas. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I about 9 months ago started experiencing a lot of fatigue and felt very exhausted. I am 38 years old with three children, and I don't have exhaustion. I have no time for exhaustion, so I'm pretty, you know, I'm in shape, and it just got worse and worse. In about 3 days, I guess, I eventually just had to go to bed because I started experiencing headaches, and like they were just bouncing around in my head, and I wasn't sick or anything in my stomach, but my muscles began to ache, and felt like my bones were throbbing a lot, and my joints began to swell. Like I was getting arthritis in my hands, and they were kind of curling up on me, and I couldn't hold anything. I couldn't bend my knees or flex my hips or turn my head.
Wow.
And my legs started swelling, and it was awful.
No, it really was awful. It sounds like you know there was something infectious that was going on. You know, when your joints ache and your body aches and you've got swelling, something else was going on in your body. Hard to pinpoint things like that and find out exactly what it was. Has it happened only one time?
It did happen one time. It lasted about 5 weeks from beginning to end. I did go to the doctor.
What'd they say?
He prescribed me antibiotics because he thought maybe I had Lyme's disease, possibly. And until he could get the blood test results back, he wanted to go ahead and put me on a really potent antibiotic.
Good choice.
And he tried that, and when the results came back in, they came back in negative. He also tested me for parvovirus, bird flu, and sent me to a rheumatologist and an autoimmune deficiency doctor.
You went to a lot of docs, and it was a great big goose egg. Nothing turned up.
Nothing ever transpired. Nothing at all. I was really upset because I felt like, okay, this could come back on me.
Right.
Nothing to.
You bet.
The only one thing that came back, which wasn't huge, but it was a vitamin D. That came back low, and like 30%.
Yeah, so. But that's not going to mean anything. I've got a suggestion for you. I have a specific suggestion. It's very, very disturbing when we don't have a diagnosis. We're used to getting diagnoses. When I started medicine, I mean, it's hard to believe it was the dark ages. When I was in training, there was no CAT scan. There was no MR scan. Ultrasounds were only beginning to come to the surface. We used to do exploratory surgery when somebody had abdominal pain and we couldn't figure out. And we didn't have the technology we have now. Now, we make the diagnosis 98% of the time, but 2 to 5%, we can't figure things out because we can't do it. You had some sort of an infectious process, and we don't know what it is. Now, you could repeat the Lyme test, because sometimes the Lyme test will be positive 3 to 6 months later. And that would be the one recommendation if you're ever going to get a repeat blood test. Get it tested again to see if it was Lyme. Certainly could be Lyme disease. It may or may not come back. And frankly, if it's an infection and you had it, you may just be built up antibodies to whatever it is that really threw you into bed at 5 weeks. And unfortunately, I don't have the answer either. And as I said, we're so used to modern medicine giving us the answer that it is a disconcerting process. But it sounds like your doc did the right things, looked for the right infections, and then you saw a rheumatologist and basically other people who are looking at autoimmune disease as infections. And there's a lot of good information. So if it comes back again, they'll be able to repeat tests and see what it is. And you kind of got to live with that. That's kind of where it is. So
right.
Do call us back. Do keep us informed of what's going on. We'd be most interested.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. And Zorba, time once again now for our medical myth buster. Today's myth might interest our technical director, Brad Kohlberg, who, as you may know, is a famous local hipster drummer. It deals with the common thought that musicians suffer hearing loss. Is that always the case?
Well, maybe that's why Brad never listens to us. Maybe that's the whole thing. Musicians do suffer hearing loss.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. There's no myth involved. The greater the amount of sound and noise over the longest period of time will do it. So, in other words, if you're by great big speakers in a rock band, that's going to make a huge difference. But even in concert orchestras, the high sounds tend to be the ones that go first. Those are the ones that we use in voice recognition, especially women's voices or maybe my voice, which tends to be a tad on the high side. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that go first, and those are the ones that tend to cause the most damage. So violin players are often going to have more damage in the high string section of the orchestra, we'll say, than bass players. And the answer is for any musician is protect your ears. If you're around noise, a loud music and it's too loud, using earplugs will help protect it.
Yeah.
I mean, we know it. It won't necessarily get rid of it. But frankly, I don't think it'll do anything for Brad because those drums are so loud that he can hear them days and days later.
Brad is good. Have you ever heard him call himself a hipster drummer?
Anybody who would call himself a hipster? The way he dresses, the way he walks, everyone knows he's a hipster drummer.
No, he's hip. Anybody who would call himself a hipster drummer is definitely not hip. Let us drum out your myth. Just send your medical myths to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
That was the drum sound, I guess.
Absolutely.
800-462-7413, our number, and a listener with us now, Zorba, in Lafayette, Tennessee. Hi.
Yes, how you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
I got a dilemma. I've been to the doctor for my sinuses, and they give me just about every shot that you could come up with in my back. And they say I'm allergic to nothing, but my sinuses or whatever it is drains constantly, and at night it drains, and then it gets hung in my throat.
Got you. So what they do is when they're doing allergy testing, they take a bunch of small injections of a variety of things to see what you may be allergic to. So you've got a bunch of post-nasal drip stuff going down the back of your nose into your throat?
Yes, and I don't know how to describe it. And I sound like a pool of moose fellering in the morning.
I shouldn't be laughing, but I can just imagine what that sounds like at a boneless. I've got a couple of suggestions. First of all, you might not be allergic to something, but you can still have the problems. Do you smoke?
No. I did, but I don't. I quit smoking in 79, okay. So it's been a while
since you smoked. Are you around a smoky environment, cars, automobiles, anything that produces?
Well, I drive a truck, but I don't have anybody in it to smoke, and traveling through cities and what have you, there's always smoke and all kinds of smells going on.
Oh, sure, exactly. I've got a couple suggestions. First of all, I would recommend a neti pot. Now, a neti pot, and we'll put this up on our website, zorbapastor.org. You can connect there through Google or through Facebook. And if you go up on the website, we'll give you information on a neti pot. A neti pot, have you ever used it or heard of a neti pot?
No, I have no idea what you just said.
What it is, it's a little thing. It looks like it's an Aladdin's lamp, and you put it into your nose, and you use a salt water solution. All the instructions are in there. And it basically helps clean out the back of your nose. And it often just cleans out the mucus.
You put it in one nostril, and then it comes out the other nostril.
The other nostril. And it can clean the back of the nose. And Tom has used it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How do you like it?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. It can be very, very effective to clean the mucus out in the back of the nose. You do it before you go to sleep at night. You do it once in the morning. That may be all that you need. That would be my first recommendation. If that fails, what you want to try is a steroid nasal spray, which is a prescription drug that you get from your doctor. A steroid nasal spray. There are a bunch of them on the market. They're all good. I would get the generic one because it's the cheapest. But I do the neti pot, and if you come to our website, we'll give you all that information. But the neti pot may be exactly what's going to work for you. That's what I would try. It sounds like that's what you need to clear it out because you're not allergic to anything.
Is it called neti pot?
NETTI, and it comes under, there's one name brand that I can remember. I don't own stock in the company. It's called Sinew Cleanse, right. S-I-N, that's S-I-N-U, Cleanse, C-L-E-N-S, I believe. Sinew Cleanse, and that's a similar neti pot. You can get them everywhere. You can get them in Target, Walgreens, Walmart, CVS, okay. Super Saver. Go into any drugstore at all. Go to the pharmacist and say, I want a neti pot. And you'll get one.
I've tried everything, but I've never heard of that.
Well, give it a whirl.
It's an old-fashioned remedy that's dynamite.
I will do it. You have a good day, and thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. And before we split for the week, Zorba, I want to share this little note from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox with you. Normally, when we receive an email with the subject line reading, a minor complaint, I assume it's a member of the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police, but this note from Dave in Jacksonville, Florida, takes issue with me. I'll let Dave explain. He writes, Dear Dr. Pastor and Tom, I love your show, but when Tom says the phone number, he usually pauses between each digit. That is terrible. Numbers should be in pairs. That makes it much easier to remember. Sounds better, too. All right, Dave, I'll give it a go. 80-04-62-74-13. Or, if you'd prefer, 80-04-62-74-13. We have a line open now for you.
I think we've got a winning lottery ticket, actually, myself.
We love hearing from you, even if it's in pairs. Send your thoughts to the show in an email to
ZORBA@WPR.org.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZORBAPASTOR.org. You can also find us on Facebook, and I tweet on a regular basis.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg, the Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader of WPR,
woo-hoo!
Are the two Jedis responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran, not John Williams. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1008Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.